You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
Hello and welcome to episode 19 of Social Europe Podcast. I'm Henning Meyer, Editor-in-Chief of Social Europe. Today we bring to you a discussion between myself and Iris Bonnet of Harvard University about the issue of gender equality and what can be done about it. We hope you enjoy the conversation. So, Iris, thank you very much for joining us today. And let me start off with an introductory question. Based on your work, what are the biggest issues in gender equality, you would say?
Oh, well, the biggest issues, it's a big question. I think I have to answer it kind of in two ways. One are kind of, you know, what are the biggest issues that the kind of work that I do, focusing on behavioral insights, can solve? And then, you know, what are the generally biggest issues? So let me start with the generally biggest issues. I think the generally biggest, one of the generally biggest issues is gendercide, which is sex selective abortion and neglect of girls. And the UN now estimates that about 200 million women and girls are missing around the world. That is more than all of the people who died in the battlefield of the 20th century. So clearly that must be one of our biggest issues. I'm not claiming that I can solve that one, but because you asked me what the biggest one is, I think that would be probably very close to the top of my list.
Mm-hmm. And what is the sort of the issues that you've worked on personally?
So we worked more on issues related to the workplace and to school that had to do with unconscious bias. So there's lots of reasons that we see gender gaps. One of them is unconscious bias, and that's what we've been focusing on.
And can you explain to us what this unconscious bias is?
Well, I might best be able to do this with an example. So about 15 years ago, a colleague of mine, Kathleen McGinn, at the business school, wrote a case study on Heidi Roizen. And Heidi Roizen is a venture capitalist in Silicon Valley, is a real person. And the case study is a typical type of case study that people who have done an MBA or an undergraduate degree would be familiar with, where the case talked about how Heidi created her enterprises, invested, built networks in Silicon Valley, and became a successful entrepreneur. The case became interesting a few years later because then colleagues at Columbia Business School took this case and replaced Heidi's name with Howard. And they didn't change anything else in the case, so very same information, but gave half of their students a case of the protagonist being called Howard and the other half of the protagonist being called Heidi. And then at the end of the case, they asked students to evaluate how well these different leaders performed, but also how much they liked Heidi and Howard, respectively. And this is now, this has turned into the favorite tool for all of us kind of in the educational business, kind of to teach people about unconscious bias in the moment. Because what we find again and again is that people think that both Heidi and Howard did do a good job, so were successful and performed well, but they don't like Heidi. And they don't like Heidi because Heidi doesn't conform to our stereotypes of what a venture capitalist looks like. And she doesn't conform to our stereotypes of what a good woman does. And that's unconscious bias. So this is unbeknownst to these students and also unintentional. I mean, these students weren't out there to get Heidi or punish Heidi. You know, maybe some were, but mostly they weren't. They weren't aware that they were evaluating Heidi more harshly and differently than Howard, even though both of them did exactly the same thing. And that's what we call unconscious bias.
So that's basically pre-configured ideas of what a venture capitalist looks like and what certain roles look like.
Yeah, it's these models, images in our minds that have a lot to do with what and who we see. So seeing really is believing. As long as we don't see more female venture capitalists or, you know, male nurses for that matter, we don't naturally associate those jobs with women or men, respectively.
So, and obviously it's a catch-22 because it's so much harder to get into it in the first place and then shift the unconscious bias.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what is catch-22, but And yes, you are right. It, our mindsets are super hard to change. I'm not calling it catch 22 because I think there are things we can do. But it is not changing that mindset. So it's not diversity training. We definitely have to do other things, in particular going into organizations and de-bias how we do stuff rather than de-bias mindsets.
Yeah. And in your research, I mean, you've looked at different types of organizations. Have you found significant differences, say, between businesses, government institutions, universities and the like?
No, I wouldn't actually even think that that was a big deal. I mean, most organizations have to recruit people. They have to hire them, evaluate them. Evaluate them for promotions, the performance appraisals. And surely some of these systems differ between the public sector and the private sector and NGOs. But fundamentally, everyone has to deal with people. And as soon as we do deal with people, those biases tend to creep in. And so whenever I work with an organization, the first thing we do is just to measure, basically, just try to understand what's going on in the organization. Do they have issues? Do they have issues with gender, but more generally with diversity at the entry level, at the more senior levels? And then we're trying to think about the types of interventions that could help them level the playing field for everyone and be able to benefit from 100% of the talent pool.
And in your recent book, you propose recipes for what can be done. And some of the key insights seems to be, and you've alluded to this a bit earlier, is that you want to de-bias organizations rather than individuals. Why is this the better way?
So the first part of the book really tries hard to collect all evidence that I could possibly find on whether the types of interventions that we have been focusing on in the last 20 to 50 years, I'm saying 20 to 50, depending a bit on the country that we're in. In this country, in the United States, it started really in the 60s that we introduced diversity training programs in our companies. And so diversity training is one of the interventions that I looked at. And the biggest message here is that we typically just don't measure. And that really is, the overarching message on those types of interventions. We just do them because they're best practice, because others in our sector, in our industry, do them, or just because the law might make us check a box. And so we introduce these two-hour trainings or two-day trainings focused on de-biasing mindsets. And so this is the big message that we don't know. Kind of the second insight that I gained was that we probably have about 20 studies, which were actually done in a randomized fashion where we had a control group, which didn't get the training, and a treatment group, which got the training. And then we actually measured what difference this made in people's behaviors. For example, in one experiment, these were students in a school. Some of the students got the diversity training and others didn't. And they then evaluated whether students who had gotten diversity training were more likely to play with, interact with, like, to hang out with kids who look different from themselves in terms of race, in terms of also body, looks, just everything. And they found nothing, basically nothing. So that was quite discouraging. And that's kind of what most of these studies found. So that leads me, so it's not, that I started writing this book trying to prove that diversity training doesn't work. I started writing this book because I wanted to find evidence on what works. That's why the book is called What Works. Really anywhere. And this included diversity trainings in companies, but also included, for example, reconciliation trainings in post-conflict countries, really trying to understand how we can get into these minds. And that just proves to be super hard. It's just not an easy task. And I don't think anyone has figured out that silver bullet. I then also looked at other types of interventions. So very much in the US, you can trace the types of things that we've been doing over the last 50 years. So the first wave of interventions very much focused on diversity trainings as a compliance exercise or as a check the box exercise. And so maybe we shouldn't be too surprised that they weren't particularly effective. Then the kind of community, broadly speaking, moved into helping women and other underrepresented groups succeed in the environment they're in. So these are leadership trainings, leadership development trainings, negotiation trainings, development, just any kinds of development activities. And again, while somewhat more encouraging, we actually don't know whether they're working. And the little evidence that we do have is certainly quite mixed. So it appears as if details really matter. And the more we can turn these types of leadership trainings into real capacity building exercises, where people then are kind of building the capacity to go back into the organization and use, for example, the tools or insights that they've gained tomorrow, the more likely they will be succeeding. So that's a leadership training. And then the last kind of bucket of interventions, which have nothing to do with devising environments, are related to mentoring, sponsorship type of initiatives and networks. And more encouraging, again, so the list, I mean, it does get better as I go down this list. Got better from diversity training to leadership training to now kind of mentorship, sponsorship, and networks, because they become more hands-on and really focus on this capacity building rather than just kind of training people with abstract concepts. But that's the first part of the book. I'm just trying to understand what works, the kind of things that we've been doing. And then the last two-thirds of the book then take a different perspective and say, what if instead of focusing on the people, either fixing their minds or kind of fixing the traditionally disadvantaged groups, what if we fixed the organizations?
Okay. And how do you develop this focus on the organization?
So just broadly speaking, kind of three buckets that we could look at. A first one that is a huge one is around talent management. And maybe let me give you kind of three examples of things that organizations could be thinking about. One is a particularly low-hanging fruit, and that is our job advertisements. And more specifically, that's the language that we use in our job advertisements. And I'm saying this is low-hanging fruit because for two reasons. One, it's not really disruptive to the organization, to the processes in an organization, to be a bit smarter about how they phrase their job advertisements. And secondly, it's low-hanging fruit because we now have the technology available. There's a number of startups now who provide software for companies and organizations and agencies in the public sector, I mean, really independent where you are, to just decode, quite literally, your de-bias, your language that you use in your job ads. And for example, not use gender-specific adjectives in advertisements for teachers, which typically tend to have more feminine coded words, or male coded words when you look for an engineer. So that's, I think, a very low hanging fruit. And that's just something that every organization should do, because every organization must be interested in attracting, benefiting from a full set of talent and attracting the right kind of people.
Can you maybe give us an example for a biased job ad?
One of these companies called Textio. So definitely Google Textio. I think they do a very nice job kind of doing that. But it's also interesting that now some of the large companies, such as SAP, are developing some of these very same tools. So I think it's very safe to predict that in 5 and certainly in 10 years from now, our HR will be completely revolutionized. So that's kind of on job advertisements. But then let me go into kind of some thornier issues. And that is once people are kind of applying to jobs, how do we evaluate them? And that's where kind of a ton of bias is happening, in particular because so many of us believe, I mean, including probably you and I, believe that we are excellent interviewers. Most people think that, you know, by seeing somebody, by feeling somebody, they can really tell whether somebody's a good fit for an organization. And of course, that word fit itself already exemplifies why this is a problem, because we tend to look for people who look like we do or who look like the workforce that we already have, because that's kind of one definition of fit. And that's what interviewers, when interviewed about their interviews, would say. They would quite literally say, well, you know, I have nothing else to go by, so I'm using myself as a reference point. So we're replicating ourselves, which clearly can't be good. in terms of benefiting from the diversity of thought and background. So what do we do? It turns out that these unstructured interviews are the worst predictor of future performance. I can safely say that based on a lot of research. Worst predictor of future performance. So clearly we have to do something different. The best predictor of future performance, and that won't sound like rocket science because it isn't, is a work sample test. I mean, if I could test what I'm actually looking for in a job candidate, what kind of jobs, what kind of tasks the person is going to have to do in the future, that would, of course, give me a good sense of whether that person is qualified or not. Maybe to be more specific, I recently hired an executive assistant for myself, and we actually followed my own advice in that we created work sample tests. And I spent quite a bit of time thinking about, you know, what are the tasks that are really important to me that I really want to have a person be good at? And one of the tasks that's really important for me is scheduling. So we quite literally gave the person a scheduling problem of one of my, you know, recent trips, going to New York, speaking at UN Women and traveling to London and doing a talk there and kind of asking the person to tell us, online. So I hadn't seen the person yet at all. You know, what kind of information does he need to make sure that I'm going to have a successful trip? So work sample tests are maybe one of my most important messages, that we should really move into work sample tests. Having said this, I'm not maybe naive enough to believe that we are willing to give up the interview soon. We are quite... most people feel quite strongly about this one-on-one interview of the finalists. So here's what people can do. They can at least move from unstructured interviews to structured interviews. And a structured interview is defined by the following characteristics. First of all, we have to think about the questions that we want to ask beforehand. So quite literally, you would write down a list of 5 questions or 10 questions beforehand, and you would use the very same 5 questions in all of your interviews of the different candidates that you talk to. And not only that, but you would, in fact, rate a person's answers after each question. And that's important because what we found was that, you know, your answer to question one might influence how I perceive your answer to question two. And we can't completely exclude those order effects, of course, because I will ask the questions in some order. But we do want to at least give ourselves a chance to be slightly more objective with question 2, 3, 4, and 5. That's why we recommend rating each question right after
it was asked then.
Yeah. And then at the very end, I mean, obviously everyone will tell us that it's very important to also have an unstructured kind of part of the discussion where, for example, I can talk about the institution, I can talk about Harvard, and person can ask a question. So that's absolutely relevant. But it should be made very clear that that's not part of the interview. That's not part of the informal interview. So when I interview people now, I tell them, you know, I have 5 prepared questions, and that's for me to evaluate whether, could be great at the job that we're interviewing for. And then at the end, I'm very happy to put this aside and have, you know, a conversation with the candidate. So, there's a number of more things that people can do that I kind of go through in my book in great detail of how we also use kind of comparative evaluations in our, interviewing processes where we have found, this is joint work with Max Bezerman at the Harvard Business School and Alexander van Geen at the Erasmus University in Rotterdam. And we found that when people aren't forced to compare a job candidate with others, but basically focus on this one person, what happens in our minds is that we use these internal reference, the stereotypes, as a comparator. Because it turns out that a lot of research in behavioral science strongly suggests that it is basically impossible for our minds to make absolute judgments. This has nothing to do with gender or people in particular, but just imagine the coffee that you drank this morning or the bread that you ate this morning. How much did you like it? And whether or not you liked it or how much you liked it has something to do with the kinds of coffees that you're used to drinking or the kinds of breads that you're used to eating. And the same thing is happening for people. So we have this urge to compare people with something that we're used to, the kinds of coffees that we've been drinking or the kinds of people that we have been confronted with in this kind of job. So in order to overcome that stereotype, what we show is that if we then, after we have done our interviews, let's say with 10 different candidates, we compare candidates across questions, that would be much better in calibrating our judgments than just kind of just focus on one candidate exclusively.
And these questions would still be designed to try to identify organizational fit?
So I don't like the word organizational fit. But because fit, again, when you ask people what fit means to them, they will typically tell you, I kind of look for somebody who looks like me or looks like us. So fit means going for homogeneity, going for people who kind of look like us. So that's why I'm a little concerned about fit. But yes, ideally, of course, what we would have to do is keep track of which of the questions that we use are in fact predictive of future performance. So big companies have done that. So Google, for example, has kept track of which of their questions are particularly predictive of future success at Google. And then they exchange questions, right? So in future years, they know question 5, for example, might not have been useful, and they try out a new question. So that's the ideal scenario. I totally get it. Not every organization is as big as Google. Not every organization has the analytical capabilities as Google does. But that would be the ideal scenario, because nobody can really tell you which questions are, you know, particularly great in your specific organization. I mean, that's actually where your earlier question of, you know, what are the differences between organizations, where that becomes relevant. I mean, for an engineering job, maybe a different question is relevant than for a managerial job. I mean, you know, there's no question about that.
So there's a lot of learning by doing in this as well.
Oh, there's learning by doing. But again, there are now startups who have developed the technology to make it easier for us to not have to reinvent the wheel. Again, I'm totally aware that a large majority of our companies have fewer than 50 employees. So they never have the kind of data to do big data analytics the way Google does. So they are called Be Applied. That's a UK company. It's part of the Behavioral Insights team of the UK. And they've developed, a great, great software, which walks people through what I just described. I mean, it's more complex than that, but basically very much builds on the insights in my book on anonymizing applicants, something we haven't talked about yet, but just taking out demographic information. So I'll get back to that in just a second, but take out demographic information completely from the job application. And then kind of thinking about these predictive questions, evaluating those questions comparatively, and then also benefiting from what they call the wisdom of the crowd, in that we have different evaluators look at the different answers to the questions and submit their own scores independent of each other. So that's another very important insight, because so many organizations do these panel interviews, which I urge people to discontinue tomorrow. Because there's so much evidence suggesting that when we do this kind of work in a group, we will, of course, influence each other. So if we have 5 people on the panel, these are not 5 independent observations, but it's basically a sample size of 1 with 5 people just influencing each other. So much better for these 5 people, if you want to take 5, to have independent evaluations or independent interviews with the candidate. So Be Applied is one. That's a UK one. In the US, we have one that is called Unitive. Another great software and platform, doing some very similar things with some, you know, of course, tweaks and differences, but also building on behavioral science, anonymizing, the applications, and then walking people through a very structured process of interviewing, work sample tests, and evaluations. So yes, it is, you know, learning by doing, but maybe more importantly, either using a technology that is built on lots of insights, or if you want to learn by doing, don't just learn by do, but learn by measuring and really evaluating what's happening.
And what has been your experience? Are organizational leaders open to changing the ways they recruit people I mean, at the end of the day, the aim must be to create more diverse and as a result, better performing organizations.
Yeah. So I think we're at the beginning of this journey. So I would say there are about 20-ish startups in the space now, and most of them emerged in the last 2 years. So there's one that is a bit older that is called Edge, that is a Swiss company that helps companies self-evaluate, just measure how well they do in terms of gender equality, for example, in terms of pay or representation, but also just evaluate how well they do in terms of the kinds of input factors that are correlated with gender equality. So it's happening, but you know, it's happening now. I mean, there's a reason we have to interview now. It really is happening now. So there are, you know, you might know that the UK government announced recently that they will move to blind evaluation procedures. So blind evaluation procedures, I want to come back to that, I think is something that is going to happen very soon. That's that organizations such as UK government, which of course is the biggest employer in the UK, will not know whether a male or female is applying for the job, or what nationality or what race or ethnicity the person has, because often, of course, that comes with the name that we see in our applications. And I think that's super promising. Now, in contrast to the UK, there are other countries, such as Germany and Switzerland, for example, Switzerland being my home country, where we still use photos with our CVs and we still add photos to our applications, which is a horrible practice. So again, lots of evidence that, what somebody looks like is not a good predictor of future performance. So in terms of blind evaluations, I'm actually quite optimistic that more and more organizations will pick that up and literally either work with one of these startups and blind themselves to the names of the applicants or do it themselves.
Well, I mean, you say we are right at the beginning of this journey, and I hope our conversation today can help to popularize some of these steps that you suggest and then have a proven impact. Iris, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today. And I hope, you know, that a lot of leaders will take your advice.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.